Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's final media roundtable of 2016. Right after the election, the shocking victory of Donald Trump led many in the media to ask, how did we fail to predict this victory? How did we get it so wrong? Well, the New York Times headline back in March says it all, $2 billion worth of free media for Donald Trump. And then there's that quote from CBS CEO Les Moonves from an investor meeting last December, quote, go Donald, keep getting out there. This is fun. Let them spend money on us, end quote. According to the Washington Post, CNN's 2016 profits are expected to reach a record $1 billion. Fox's profits will top $1.6 billion, and MSNBC will bring in $279 million. After a year of 24/7 nonstop, mostly uncritical coverage of Donald Trump, what have the media learned, and what should we expect in 2017? Also this year, the horrors of the war in Syria, the violence in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the influx of refugees into Europe gave us a glimpse into the lives of millions of people who have fled war and poverty. And on the domestic front, with all eyes on the presidential race, many issues did not receive the attention they deserve. Joining us to talk about the media in 2016 and what we can and should expect next year are three journalists. Daniel Denver is a freelance journalist and former staff writer with Salon. Daniel hosts a podcast, a new podcast on politics, criminal justice, and immigration called The Dig Radio. Hi, Daniel. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. Li Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. He is the author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. It explores how the conservative right rebuilt the Republican Party in the aftermath of President Obama's 2008 election victory. Hi, Li. Thank you for joining us and welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Eileen Two Rocks is a contributor for Hoy Los Angeles and Unidos. She also writes for various Latin American publications, and she's the author of Dreamers, an immigrant generation's fight for their American dream. Hi, Eileen. Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have all of you. So this is the last media roundtable of the year, and as we always do on the show, we like to highlight good journalism because there is so much good journalism out there. Unfortunately, it doesn't always get the attention it deserves. But I'd like to ask all of you, you know, so much has happened this year, and I just wonder what stands out for you as some of the most important stories of 2016. Eileen, let's start off with you. What stands out for you?
Let me tell you that, you can expect, I tend to look to the Spanish language media, to those media that are called the ethnic media, because normally they are overlooked by mainstream media, by media in English, by those that have the great headlines that are reproduced ad infinitum in the next days or sometimes the next week. But I think that ethnic media has been doing very good reporting, especially not covering just by minorities, which is a misunderstanding sometimes when you talk about ethnic media. Most people, including the president-elect, believe that a media like Univision covers issues just for Latino media and about, the Latino community and about the Latino community. And this is not true. They cover from a Latino perspective about people who are living in the U.S. as most other citizens in the U.S. Having the same concerns and addressing the same issues. How are you getting a new job if you don't have one? How are your kids are going to go to school if you don't have documents or you don't have money enough to pay for a university, et cetera? I believe those kind of media, and especially Univision.com, did a very good job during this election. They had a couple of reporters, one of them is Maria Ramirez. They follow the election in a very detailed way because every time one of the candidates, and they did that especially with Donald Trump, said something, they immediately started to check, to fact check that. And they found very interesting things, and they were reproducing some other ethnic media and Spanish language media, and unfortunately, this doesn't have an echo in other in media in other language, in English or in mainstream media. I think that the fact checking that they did in Univision.com during this election was outstanding. They saw it coming in several ways, and I think it's a moment for people working in English media and mainstream media to start taking a look to what these ethnic media are doing when they work political issues among our communities, because they know their people, they know our minorities, they know the way they think. And that may be a good input for a future month.
And Eileen, just quickly, what are some of your other favorite ethnic media sources?
Well, I think we have a lot. I have to choose what to say. Radio Ambulante, you know, they have the first Spanish language podcast in NPR this year,
right.
And they have done in-depth stories in a very sensitive way, in a way that they invest following up in stories that are not shocking, they're not breaking news, but they just follow on stories and issues that, you know, sometimes because we are looking the fast click on the internet or we need to run from one story to the other, we don't take the time to do. I know that there's a lot of English media doing that, you know, those that have the resources, but in Spanish sometimes we have very limited resources and we are still doing that. So I think Radio Ambulante has done an astounding job. And also, there's a reporter in Arizona, Valeria Fernandez. She contributes for CNN en Español and also for Radio Bilingüe. And her coverage about immigration, and to give you one example, she was very close when this so-called wave of unaccompanied minors came to the U.S. 2 years ago from Central America. And if you remember, many media were talking about that for a while, and then we suddenly forgot about those children, but those children are still here in the country, many of them separated from their families. And she has done a great job following up on these stories that are still happening among our communities.
Hmm. That is Eileen Two Rocks, a contributor for Hoy Los Angeles and Unidos, and she also writes for various Latin American publications. And what about you, Daniel Denver? What stands out for you as some of the most important stories of the year?
Well, I definitely want to second Radio Ambulante for Spanish speakers out there. It's an excellent show, often referred to as like a Spanish This American Life, which isn't quite doing it justice because it's its own deal and does its own great storytelling. And then I would like to call out the Marshall Project, which has done some really excellent reporting, not only on criminal justice, but also on immigration enforcement. Recently, Christy Thompson had a really great piece on the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, where thousands of immigrants basically end up there in the middle of nowhere with no due process rights or opportunities to access a lawyer. And it was a really devastating in-depth investigation. Then I would also say the New York Times, especially Tom Robbins, who I think is also a Marshall Project person, actually, ongoing investigation of brutality perpetrated by prison guards throughout the New York State prison system and the environment of total impunity that they typically act within. And then lastly, a publication that I think that left-leaning listeners should definitely consider picking up that's been getting a lot of attention recently is Jacobin, J-A-C-O-B-I-N, which is a new-ish, not that new, maybe a few years old, socialist, very smart socialist magazine, and their most recent issue has a lot of really intelligent discussion about what the left should be, how the left should be thinking moving forward, both inside and outside the Democratic Party, which I think is a critical conversation to have right now.
Yeah, very critical to have. That's Daniel Denver, a freelance journalist who hosts a podcast on politics, criminal justice, and immigration called The Dig Radio. And what about you, Li Fong? What were some of your most memorable stories of the year?
Well, you know, just looking back over the year, one kind of noteworthy form of journalism or critique of journalism was the parody preacher that was created by several people called Carl Digler. Carl Digler was basically a composite character taking kind of the worst attributes of some of the most famous pundits and journalists. And when I say worst, I mean folks who kind of view politics and campaigning through the prism of sports, to try to flatten all kind of political and societal issues as kind of superficial counts of, you know, who's up and who's down. We see this all over the media, and so this character that was created and syndicated by Cafe.com was really just a fantastic way of getting a little bit of a lighthearted retreat from the normal kind of day-to-day news cycle, but still having a critical eye at the kind of systemic problems in American punditry and reporting. So Carl Digler, one of the big highlights of the year. I thought for political coverage, The Guardian did a really good job of covering Trump voters of areas where Trump gained unexpected success, particularly in the Midwest and Appalachia, in a very savvy way. They had Gary Young go to Ohio and wrote some very beautiful essays talking about his experience there, talking to voters. Paul Lewis of The Guardian did a video series going to the poorest county in West Virginia, which also coincidentally had one of Trump's highest turnout ratings in the entire country for the primary. Really just not caricaturing any of these people, talking to them, hearing them out. Many of them, surprisingly, were actually Obama voters in the past, and they'd flipped to Trump. And I thought it was a very thoughtful, nuanced way to look at the election and to look at the Trump phenomenon. And finally, just one other piece I want to highlight, and that was just last week in Politico, how Clinton lost Michigan and blew the election by Edward Isaac DeVore.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a classic Politico TikTok piece with lots of insider information, but it's just every paragraph is jaw-dropping, talking about how union officials and local officials in Michigan were desperately pleading with the Clinton campaign, asking for resources, wanting to spend more on get-out-the-vote operations, and that they were rebuffed over and over and over again, that the Clinton campaign even diverted resources to Chicago because they wanted to kind of inflate their popular vote count, because there was some kind of fear that Trump would lose the Electoral College but win the popular vote. So they were diverting resources from the Midwest to places like Chicago and New Orleans so they could increase the popular vote count. And then just like kind of comical missteps, you know, not asking Obama to campaign over the last weekend. You know, Obama just went golfing on a Saturday before Election Day because he wasn't asked by the Clinton campaign to do anything. And that, you know, even on Election Day, that morning, local Michigan officials noticed a 25% drop in turnout in minority and urban communities, but the Clinton campaign continued to ignore them and apparently started drinking and celebrating mid-afternoon and talking about what kind of spots they would get on the transition. And it wasn't until, of course, later that night they realized that they should have listened to the folks on the ground in Michigan.
Yeah, that really was an incredible story. And Lee, since you brought up the Gary Young piece in The Guardian about Trump voters, I wanted to ask all of you this question, because after the election, so many in the media were saying, how did we get this so wrong? What happened here? And now what they're saying is we need to reach out and understand Donald Trump voters. Does this mean that we should expect more coverage of issues that actually matter to working people, like jobs, healthcare, and the environment? One thing that's really struck me is Vox recently did a big package about Obamacare and spoke to a number of Trump voters who had no idea that his plan is to repeal Obamacare. The AP also had a piece about Steve Mnuchin, the appointee to be Treasury Secretary, who made so much money off the foreclosure crisis, and interviewed a woman whose home was foreclosed, who said she had no idea that this was going to happen and she regretted voting for Donald Trump. So it seems like a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump don't know where he stands on issues, which says a lot about media. Eileen, do you think that now that the media are really kind of looking inward, are they going to actually focus on real issues that matter to people?
Well, we should expect that. I mean, this was a very hard lesson. The facts are going to last for a while. You mentioned previously that someone says during the coverage of Trump, this is fun. Well, this kind of fund has its price, and the price, as usual, is going to be paid by minorities in this case. So we as media have a very hard lesson to learn out of this. When you say these voters had no idea where their candidate stands in issues, whose fault is that? Mm. I mean, we are the media. We are there to inform exactly about that, not the candidate who goes to an event to present the platform because they say what they want to say. But we are in charge of looking for the information, the hard information, and to give that to our audiences. We fail in doing that. Let me tell you, when I had the chance to cover several campaign events during this campaign, for Hillary Clinton, for Bernie Sanders, for Donald Trump. And of course, in the case of Donald Trump, you would see people with very radical positions in some events, for example, here in California or in Arizona, even violent events you would find if you are covering that. And every time you see that media covering there are going to give the microphones and are going to give the voice and are going to talk to the guys who were more violent, mm-hmm. who were more extremist, who were more rude. But let's say you are in an event with 1,000 people and maybe 2 people are violent. And those are the people who the media are going to interview. That way, you're not going to get the pulse or the sense of who really these people going to that event is. Who are they thinking? Maybe you are interviewing or you're giving voice to the anti-immigrant or to the people who, I don't know, are racist. But it's most likely that most of the people there are not anti-immigrant or are not racist. They're only facing another kind of issues. I think that's the main aspect where we fail as media when covering those events where we had really the chance to understand those people thinking of voting about one of these candidates, and we missed that chance. So yes, now we have to start to people to really start talking to people, really trying to understand what are their motives, why are they not trusting in common politics or in the establishment in traditional politics, and also trying to understand their environment by talking to local reporters. I think we gave so much focus to national reporters traveling to several cities, spending a few hours in each city, and then explaining of why the electorate in that city acts like that, the way they do, or how are they thinking. We have local reporters in every community who understand their own communities. We have to start networking with them. We have to start listening to local media, and sorry for repeating this, but also to ethnic media, to minority media, to understand really where these people are coming from.
Eileen Two Rocks is a contributor for Hoy, Los Angeles, and Unidos, and she writes for various Latin American publications. We're also joined today by Daniel Denver, a freelance journalist who runs a podcast called The Dig Radio, and Lee Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. Lee, what are your thoughts about lessons learned? The Washington Post and The New York Times says that they're going to ramp up their White House coverage. Given the current model that these media outlets operate under, do you think that they will do a better job of actually covering issues, real issues that working people care about?
No, I'm not optimistic for that at all. I think if you take a clinical kind of deep look at the failures of the media in the last 2 years, that would be the appropriate response. You know, so many hours of television were devoted just to having pundits representing the Clinton or Trump campaign yell at each other, or just cutting to campaign rallies, or obsessively talking about poll numbers without discussion of the issues and how the candidates' positions would affect society and affect bread and butter issues like jobs or healthcare. I think we are at a crossroads where the media is looking back and saying, well, how can we change in this new Trump era, how can we adapt? And although they should reflect on their own failures and cover policy and politics in a more substantive way, I think, if I had to predict, instead I think many media outlets will hire more columnists and pundits that represent the kind of nativist right-wing populism that Trump represents, so they can pander to those views, mm-hmm. and that so that they can inoculate themselves with the new administration. I think that's the most likely outcome, but it certainly isn't the most idealistic.
Daniel, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I want to second Lee's comment that especially the TV news coverage has been truly garbage over the last year. I mean, the proportion of airtime that major networks gave to Donald Trump versus Bernie Sanders at a time when they had virtually the same support in public opinion polls, I believe. I think it was something, it was like hundreds of minutes to versus 11 minutes or something. And as Les Moonves said, I think the rest of his quote was, you know, this might be bad, might not be good for America, but it's great for CVS. I think that the media really, the televised media really shamelessly used Trump for ratings and ad revenue, and Trump, you know, used them in return, and that it was a pretty happy partnership. I think the print reporting is more of a mixed record. I think there have been some really great probing and depth stories, including ones that really highlight the precarious and difficult situation that so many Americans find themselves in. But on the other hand, the coverage was also very much dominated by the horse race that was so well mocked by Carl Digler. In terms of understanding Trump voters, I do think that's important. I think one book that I would recommend was Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, which came out before Trump's win, but is an in-depth look at right-wing everyday politics in Louisiana, and politics that seem to be in contradiction to these people's own self-interest. But it's a very sympathetic, empathetic look. On the other hand, though, I caution against this kind of rush to kind of anthropologically understand the white working class. I think it's important to remember that the working class, that Hillary Clinton failed to appeal to working class people as a whole, not just white workers. White workers may have gone for Trump, but many other white workers stayed home and didn't vote, and many people of color didn't vote as well.
Right. That is Daniel Denver, a freelance journalist and former staff writer with Salon. Daniel hosts a podcast on politics, criminal justice, and immigration called The Dig Radio. We're also joined today by Lee Fong, an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. He is the author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. It explores how the conservative right rebuilt the Republican Party in the aftermath of President Obama's 2008 victory. And Eileen Torox is a contributor for Hoy Los Angeles and Unidos. She writes for a number of Latin American publications, and she is the author of Dreamers, an immigrant generation's fight for their American dream. And today it is our final media roundtable of 2016. The year has been filled with major stories, from the ongoing and tragic war in Syria and the refugee crisis to the presidential election, and hundreds of Native American tribes, 300, resisting the Dakota Access oil pipeline at Standing Rock. So today we are talking about what the media have learned from mostly uncritical 24/7 coverage of Donald Trump, and then also what should we expect in 2017. And you can find the stories that we're talking about today at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to a pre-recorded edition of Your Call. No calls, please, but we do welcome your feedback to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And a reminder that you can hear this again if you're missing part of this 10 o'clock broadcast. It'll be rebroadcast this afternoon at 5. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point. Vivian Labatin talks about her advocacy organization, Make It Work, that's advocating for paid family leave, equal pay, and affordable child care. Coming up at 11.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today it is our last media roundtable of 2016. Today we are speaking with three journalists about the highlights of the year, what the media missed, coverage of Donald Trump, 24/7, nonstop, mostly uncritical coverage of Donald Trump. Remember that headline in the New York Times from March, $2 billion worth of free media for Donald Trump. So what have the media really learned? What changes can we expect in 2017? Today, we're joined by Daniel Denver, a freelance journalist and former staff writer with Salon. Daniel hosts a podcast on politics, criminal justice, and immigration called The Dig Radio. Lee Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. And Eileen Two Rocks contributes for Hoy Los Angeles and Unidos. She also writes for various Latin American publications. And I'm glad you're all making distinctions between the cable shows and print. And then also there's radio. And I just want to ask you, before we dive into more coverage, what is the best thing that citizens can do to make their voices heard? Because I'm just hearing so many complaints about the media, more than ever, really, in the wake of the election. What is the best thing people can do? I mean, everybody now has a Twitter account, obviously email. Eileen, what would you say? How can people get involved in trying to reform the media?
Well, I think community radio has done a very good job in this way, especially in recent months. When you see the shows and the topics that these stations that are founded by their own audiences, and, you know, we have very small community radios in some states, and we have these stations that are larger, these chains like Radio Bilingue, for example, here in California, that has several points across the state, and they also cover several issues. But I think that moving towards that model where the audiences are funding their own media, and especially radio, that's not that hard to do, and they can create a real connection, a real relationship, not only with the project, with the station, but also with the people working in there. I see that there's a tendency that people working for community radios, reporters, producers, are more engaged to their communities. They know what they want, they know what they need, and people feel comfortable reaching out to them, because if you're funding the work they're doing and you know there are not other monies in there with other interests, you feel that they're going to listen to you and they can give you what you want. I think that's harder when you're talking about print, although we have seen very good experiences about that. And also going to mass media, well, that's going to be a little bit harder, although we are seeing that New York Times has been receiving a huge amount of subscribers after the election. So this says that people, it's understanding finally that if they want certain kind of journalism, they have to pay for that, because if not, other people are going to pay for that, and the interests of those people can be reflected on that. So community media, not only social media, but community media, we have to start involving people, getting them engaged in the work that we do. And of course, that starts in a community level. I think that's the way.
Mm. And supporting community radio and independent media.
Of course.
Lee Fong, what would you add?
You know, it's a tough question, because, you know, people don't have a lot of power to affect the media, at least ordinary people don't. Mm. We see so many media outlets that are now supported by very wealthy foundations or individuals, my own included, we see so many other local and independent media outlets kind of withering on the vine. So, you know, I just want to reiterate that people should subscribe and pay for independent media and work in their local communities and on the national level to support some type of larger reform to make media more accessible. We need to completely rethink the model because this 100% privately financed or almost 100%, I guess there's PBS and some others and NPR, but almost 100% privately funded media system hasn't been working. And maybe a centralized solution like the BBC would not be an appropriate response, or not something that Americans would feel comfortable with. But, you know, there are a lot of other interesting ideas that I've seen. You know, my colleague John Schwartz talks about the idea of democracy vouchers. You know, we talk about vouchers that folks can use in publicly financed campaigns. Well, there's also the idea that the government could give citizens vouchers that they could use to support civic organizations and local media outlets as some type of society building investment. So, you know, there are a lot of ideas out there, but in the short term, you know, if something is happening in your community and you see an opportunity to document some type of misdeed or to document some type of corruption, you know, social media provides a great opportunity and a platform for doing that. And if you can, you know, this is the holiday season, get someone a subscription to independent media because, you know, they're hurting for money.
Yeah, that's so true. Daniel, what would you add?
Yeah, I want to echo what's already been said, which is that, you know, support not only independent media but local media. There's more, one can access more news than ever before about faraway places today, and that's great. But on the local city level, town level, state house level, things have just been totally decimated. But also, I think that ultimately the best way for people to change the media conversation is for people to take political action that changes the political conversation. If we look at the last few years, if we look at Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, and then the Bernie Sanders campaign, we really see that it's regular people organizing for justice that can have an enormous change in bringing about a new way of discussing the economy, the criminal justice system, and then the media plays catch up. And I think that's one way that people can have an impact.
I want to spend some time talking about fake news, talking about profits. Facebook, in the first three quarters of this year, made about $6 billion in profit, a big jump from $3.6 billion last year. They now have almost 2 billion users. And, you know, Facebook has taken $1 billion away from print publications in the past year, according to reports. Lee, you've done a lot of reporting on fake news sites. First off, The Guardian had a piece called 2016, the year Facebook became the bad guy. For people who might not be very familiar with fake news, how big of an issue and a problem is this?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to quantify. And even the term fake news is very controversial, right? Because, you know, we've had political propaganda and media outlets falsely reporting information forever, right? That's not new. But what is new is that a majority of Americans now receive their news from their Facebook feed, and a number of companies and news proprietors have basically taken advantage of the Facebook algorithm to create absolutely false information, and they've kind of gamed the algorithm so that they are now receiving more traffic than legitimate news stories from legitimate news sites. So some of these sites are kind of fly-by-night operators, just kind of entrepreneurs in the U.S., some of them actually in Macedonia and elsewhere, that are creating political sites and then making fake news stories that seem to confirm people's biases. So, you know, they'll create liberal sites that say every vaccine will kill you, and they will make conservative sites that says that Hillary Clinton is a Satan worshiper that kills children. And, you know, it might seem silly, but, you know, recent studies have shown that for a lot of Americans, including one particular study out of Stanford last month, found that middle school students shown a number of options between real news, real content, and absolutely false made-up content, they can't distinguish the difference. And on the Facebook news feed, a lot of these fake news proprietors, folks that are just constantly making up viral political stories to smear certain individuals or political actors, Facebook actually verifies them and gives them the blue check mark as a legitimate news outlet. So, you know, we did a story on that showing just that several associates of Donald Trump actually own several of these political fake news sites that have been verified by Facebook that spread constant propaganda against Democrats, against Hillary Clinton, just completely making up stories, claiming that, you know, Obama changed the White House logo and put a white flag of surrender on top of it to signal surrender to Al-Qaeda, which, you know, this kind of stylized white logo has existed for decades, including under Republican presidents. Just a made-up story, but, you know, for the Republican audience that likes this type of thing, a lot of folks clicked on it. A lot of this content gets millions of views, and actually some of these sites, there's one such site created called Conservative Tribune. It has more online traffic than the Wall Street Journal,
wow,
than NPR, than ABC News.
Wow.
And so they've really gamed the Facebook news feed. So they're getting a ton of traffic and making a lot of money, but also affecting the political discourse.
You know, it's easy for some of us to sort of poo-poo this, but this is really serious. You write, Lee, in your piece about fake news, that Laura Ingraham, a Donald Trump ally who's under consideration to be the White House press secretary, owns an online publisher called Ingraham Media Group that runs a number of websites, including LifeZet, a site that frequently posts these kinds of articles. One of the videos was titled The Clinton Body Count, and the video received over 400,000 shares and 14 million views. I mean, a lot of people follow these websites.
Yeah, I mean, just in context, less than a million people watch MSNBC, so... You know, it's you know, these things have a lot of impact, and they're new. You know, LifeZet just launched 2 years ago, but really got going this year. And Donald Trump is not disavowing any of this. In fact, as you mentioned, Laura Ingraham might be Donald Trump's liaison to the press as his press secretary, and this is someone who actually owns a fake news website.
Wow. Lee Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept and author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. Daniel Denver is a freelance journalist who runs a podcast on politics and immigration called The Dig Radio. Eileen Two Rocks contributes for Oi Los Angeles and Unidos, and she's the author of Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Eileen, did you have anything you'd like to add on fake news, these stories that are pushed out as propaganda, and how journalists should deal with this?
Oh, God, I listen to Lee, and I'm very depressed right now. I think this is the biggest challenge that we are going to have in the years to come. I, as a reporter, the only thing that I feel that I can do is just to report accurately in the subjects, in the issues that really matter. And I think at the end, yes, we will not get 14 million hits or clicks, or we are not going to get viral in on the internet, but we still have to keep doing our job. To me, a big concern right now is that when you're having this fake news and you are trying to find out what is real, we tend to go to the big names. If the New York Times publishes it, or if CNN publishes it, maybe that's legit, and we are going to trust them. We are relying in the big brands to find the who are giving us real information. But we are in a moment in media where many of our good reporters, good journalists, are not based in a newsroom. We have a lot of people freelancing, very good people, people who have been working in mainstream media, in large newsrooms for 20, 25 years, and now they're freelancing, and even younger people. But, you know, newsrooms, media companies are not the same. They don't have the resources. So they have a lot of people just freelancing, contributing to them. So how are you going to give credibility to a person if all they have is just their name and not a big brand behind them? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a huge concern, because I know a lot of colleagues that are involved in very interesting projects, independent projects. They're looking for their own funding. To me, the next years, in the coming years, we're going to see a lot of journalism collectives, journalists working together, even in different points of the country or even the world, trying to focus on issues that matter and trying to look for funding, not for creating a new media, but for creating a new project to talk about specific issues. But if we still relying in the big brands that are going to give us the trust, the confidence that what we are seeing or we are reading is true,
these journalists are going to have a very hard time to keep doing their job. So there are tough times, but I still think that as reporters, we have to do our best. We have to follow up stories that matter, not only stories that sell. And, of course, we have to keep telling stories of real people, putting names, putting faces on it. I know we say this a lot, but it's still true. If you put a face and you put a name, you have a story there. People like stories if they're real.
Daniel, what would you add?
I don't want to draw a false equivalency between fake news and the mainstream media, but I do think it's important to say that the mainstream media in many ways laid the groundwork for the rise of fake news. Obviously, the technological platform of social media was what allowed it to happen ultimately, but I think first, mainstream media like the New York Times caused major credibility problems for themselves by basically laundering the Bush administration's false case for the invasion of Iraq. That's a very specific but big example. But then more generally, I think that the mainstream media, by just portraying the state of the United States, as the Hillary Clinton campaign would put it, sort of as America is already great, that globalization is marching on and bettering everyone every day, I think that the rosy coverage of the state of society, the ever-improving our ever more perfect union, that kind of tone increasingly felt false and in contradiction to people's lived realities. And I think that's one thing that created the opening for fake news. Obviously, also broadcast media, television played a huge role in this. CNN, before they were giving wall-to-wall coverage for Donald Trump, was giving wall-to-wall coverage of the one runaway bride and the disappearing airplane. I mean, just the convergence of reality television and the infotainment that the CNN pretends is news, that they ultimately converged and helped produce a president buoyed by fake news is not entirely surprising.
Lee, what would you say to that? Not many people bring up the connection that Daniel makes about the mainstream media being very guilty of this.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason folks are so distrustful of kind of legacy media is that they've been fed a number of lies, whether it's the big lies of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or kind of the more subtle ones, about the state of the economy and healthcare. There are these kind of subtle biases that make people distrustful of the media, but it's certainly both. How you repair that, I don't know, because on the flip side of that argument, these legacy media outlets are the only institutions with the resources to hold powerful people accountable, to explain every day what's going on in everyday society to Americans. You can't completely abandon them, because who fills the void? It's more of these kind of fly-by-night operators with absolutely no editorial standards. It's a tough problem.
Going back to the election, the question that is still really front and center is why Hillary lost to someone like Donald Trump. And we're getting now, Russia is dominating the headlines. In the weeks following the election, it was about rural white voters, and then it morphed into sort of a combination of FBI Director James Comey's letter and the role of Russia, and now Russia is really dominating. Eileen, how are you reflecting on these issues, and what do you think about the fact that all of the attention is now on Russia? So much
yes,
of it.
Yes, we are creating this cycle where an issue becomes relevant, because it becomes important. Everybody runs after that. And at the end, not much happens. I don't know if this is going to be the case. I'm originally from Mexico. I've been living here for 12 years. So to me, this kind of conflict post-election is something that is common in the country where I live. You can find this kind of thing in our elections, because the system is rigged, because we have several issues going around. To me, seeing this happening in the U.S. is really, really new. And it surprises me a lot. And I'm very curious, trying to find out how the media are going to work this, in the sense that
you have to give information, you have to find information and put it out there so something happens. Because to me, the recent months, you mentioned the 20-something months that we have been repeating what Donald Trump said, we're still repeating that because this person is still using his Twitter account and he says whatever he wants and nothing happens. Mm. There are no consequences, there are no legal consequences of it. And that has me very surprised, really, because that's something that I did not expect when this election started. If we are finding something about Russia, let's find it. And let's do our job and let's put the information out there. But my concern and what I'm curious about is what's going to happen, because sometimes some media and some journalists are doing their job, are doing good journalism. During the election, yes, we had a lot of noise, but we also had people saying this is happening, fact-checking, this is not right, this is wrong. And nothing happened. There were no consequences. So, of course, we have a role, but there are also other parties involved. And if we are trying to report, we're putting the information out there, and nothing happens, then you start asking yourself, what's the purpose of doing journalism if nothing changes? Mm-hmm. Even with real information, nothing changes. I don't know if we're going to get enough good information out of this, or if this is just going to be a cycle and we are just going to move on to the next one. But if we are trying to get the facts, if we are trying to understand, to explain, and to put information out there, and to put evidence out there, and nothing happens, and it has happened during the last month, you know, that's disencouraging.
Hmm. Lee, what would you add?
I mean, the hacking of the DNC, DCCC, and Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, that's a huge mystery, and we deserve to know the truth. There should be an open investigation. You know, Republicans are being very hesitant to have an open one. I see that they're having a closed-door intelligence committee briefing, but there needs to be an open investigation. So there are no questions lingering, and this is a fairly unprecedented step, if indeed it was Russia that hacked the Democrats to throw the election to Trump. That being said, I am a little bit disturbed by the discourse the last couple of weeks, obsessing over Russia's role. I really doubt that the hacked emails had a significant impact on the campaign, even though this was an important event. You know, we just talked earlier about the Clinton campaign refusing to campaign in parts of the Midwest where her loss was ultimately decisive in her presidential loss. And, you know, there's so many systemic problems with the Democratic Party. Why did they coordinate Hillary Clinton despite all these obvious character flaws, an investigation from the FBI, the kind of fact that in so many ways she embodies the type of political corruption and pay-to-play political dealings that Americans are generally very upset at. Why is the Democratic Party so controlled by this small group of insiders? It's going to be very important for the Democratic Party moving forward to identify the flaws in the election and identify flaws in the Democratic infrastructure, the big unions, the think tanks, the Democratic groups that are all controlled by a relatively small network of professional Democrats that have done very poorly in the last 8 years. It wasn't just Hillary Clinton's loss. Barack Obama presided over the largest loss of legislative seats, House seats, and Senate seats of any president in American history, unless you count, I think one election in the mid-19th century. So, you know, there are big systemic problems that the Democrats need to talk about. And I think this Russia thing, although very important to investigate, is shaping up to be a little bit of a distraction, a convenient distraction for folks who don't want to look inwards.
Daniel, how do you analyze that?
Yeah, I agree with what Lee just said. I mean, is my hunch that Russia orchestrated these hacks? Like, yes, but also I think we've seen a lot of reports in the media that are basically taking strongly suggestive circumstantial evidence as ironclad proof, which is not. But even if it was Russia, which I'm certainly won't be surprised if it turns out that it was, I do really think that Democrats are desperate to find any excuse for why Trump won that doesn't involve dealing with the fact that Hillary Clinton was a pretty horrible and unpopular candidate. I mean, if at the end of the day, what did these emails reveal? That Hillary Clinton is the sort of person that has, that she's the sort of candidate that people suspected she was, the kind of person who has these behind-the-scenes talks with corporations and says she Wall Street banks and says that she has public and private positions on matters. If the revelation of Clinton being who people suspected she was enough to throw the election, then that doesn't speak very highly of Hillary Clinton or the Democratic Party establishment.
We have just 1 minute left. If you can quickly go around and talk about what you're looking forward to report on in 2017. Daniel?
I guess the first thing on the top of my list right now is that there's been a lot of understandable fear over what Jeff Sessions will look like as the Attorney General in terms of the state of our horribly broken criminal justice system and criminal justice reform. That said, most of the people incarcerated in the United States are incarcerated at the state level, and police are mostly, law enforcement is mostly locally controlled. So I'm really interested in exploring in what ways people who live in cities, who mostly did not vote for Donald Trump, can push people like Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York and Rahm Emanuel in Chicago and Jim Kenney in Philadelphia to finally overhaul police disciplinary systems that remain profoundly broken years after Ferguson.
And Lee, quickly, what about you?
I'm very interested in covering what we were just talking about. The if there is a shakeup of the Democratic Party, will the corporate lobbyists who largely control the levers of power within the party, will they be dislodged? And what will be the role of movements going forward? Because I think a lot of Americans are looking not towards individual politicians, but larger protest movements.
Eileen?
Well, I'm an immigration reporter, so clearly this is going to be a busy year.
Yes.
Of course, I'm going to be following what's coming from the federal government, but not from Trump, from the federal government, because we have to understand that every immigration policy has to pass through the Congress, through Democrats, through Republicans, and we have pretty decent Republicans in the party. This is the moment to show that. So we have to see how are those forces, those partisan forces, those organizations who have been working with civil rights issues and immigration issues for a few years are going to play these during the next year. It's going to be very interesting.
Eileen Two Rocks contributes for Oi Los Angeles and Unidos. Her book is Dreamers and Immigrant Generations Fight for Their American Dream. Lee Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept, author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. And Daniel Denver is a freelance journalist who runs the podcast Dig Radio, focusing on politics, criminal justice, and immigration. Daniel, Lee, and Eileen, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your reporting. We look forward to having you on in the new year.
Thanks.
Happy New Year. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thank you. This is our last media roundtable of 2016, and I hope everyone has a nice holiday and a great new year. And I just want to thank our amazing team at Your Call, Laura Flynn, producer of the show, Malihe Razazan, senior producer. She produces every Friday media roundtable and finds the most amazing journalists. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David LaTulipe, Kevin Vance, Ashley Ann Krigbaum are our studio engineers, and you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call, and thank you for joining us.